It's President's Day. It's also a chance for us to take a look at the office of the presidency, how the founders envisioned it, and how its occupants have expanded the power of the position through the years. Here with me in Studio 3 to help us do just that is Stephen Knott. He's a professor of national security affairs at the Naval War College, a presidential historian, and author of the new book, The Lost Soul of the American Presidency, The Decline into Demagoguery and the Prospects for Renewal. Steve, welcome to Radio Boston.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Also with us is Thomas Whalen. He's a political historian and professor of social sciences at Boston University. Tom, welcome back to the show.
My pleasure.
And listeners, we'd love to hear from you on this President's Day as well. Is the presidency too powerful in your view? Or does the president need to be strong in order to get anything done these days? Give us a ring at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. You can also tweet us at Radio Boston. Steve, let me start with you because I want to just establish from the get-go how you see the founders' vision for the presidency. Before we explain how we've descended into demagoguery and lost our soul, as you put it, what was the baseline that we should have started from?
Well, the baseline was one that the founders conceived of the president as a unifying figure, as at least in part a head of state. And most of the founders would have rejected the sort of demagoguery that's become part and parcel of modern politics. And by modern, I mean for the last 110 or 20 years. So there was a more constrained, more restrained view of the office. The president was seen as a unifying figure. He was not, unfortunately, it's been all he was not expected to go out, beat the partisan bushes, stir the pot. He was expected to be restrained. He was expected in some ways to defer to Congress on legislative matters. I'm not necessarily arguing that we need to go back to all of that, but I do think we're in a bad spot at the moment. We've sort of torn away any of the constitutional and sort of semi-constitutional traditions that were built up around the presidency. And I think we are very much in the midst of a demagogic presidency as we sit here today.
Well, you know, oddly enough, the framework that you're describing is largely outlined, at least as you write about it, by a man who never was president, Alexander Hamilton. He also, though, wanted a very strong president in other regards. That seems like a very fine line. So how did he propose walking that line?
Sure. No, it's a terrific question. Hamilton was opposed to what he called the little arts of popularity. So he wanted to find a manner of presidential selection and prescribe a kind of conduct for the president that, as I said, was restrained. But he also believed the Constitution in Article II gave the president adequate powers to defend the nation from foreign attack and also from any sort of domestic insurrection. So I would argue that the constitutional presidency that Hamilton envisioned was the one that is sufficient to keep the American people safe, to preserve American nationhood, but it also is without the sort of demagogic downside that we have today.
Thomas Whalen, how much of this ideal, though, is just sort of built into the persona of George Washington himself? I mean, as Stephen describes, this sort of ability to have power, but also the wisdom to use restraint, that seems that there's only so many checks that, you know, institutions can put it. At some level, it requires a person who is willing to maybe curb his own ambitions. I mean, was Washington the exemplar of that?
Absolutely. They all had Washington in his mind as the first president, and they kind of built the Constitution in many ways around him. And I think it's also important to point out that the founders, most of them, including Hamilton, didn't think the Constitution would last very long, that there was going to be major changes, or at least maybe another one down the line. I think Hamilton, if he was alive today, would be very surprised that it lasted this long.
The other thing that strikes me, Stephen, reading your book, is that it didn't, in your view, take too long for this vision to kind of go off the rails. I mean, we think about, you said that in your view, there we have a demagogue in office right now. He often compares himself to Andrew Jackson. But you start sort of the timeline here way back at president number three, Thomas Jefferson. Why so?
I do, and I need to confess up front that I suffer from Jefferson derangement syndrome. But having laid that out there, I do think Jefferson sort of opened the door in terms of moving the office away from any sort of constitutional constraints and rooting the office more in public opinion and seeing the president as the voice of the majority. And then Andrew Jackson takes that and just runs with it. So that by the time you get to the 1830s and 40s, the American president is no longer a check on the potential tyranny of the majority. He's actually being presented as someone who needs to speak for the majority. And the problem with that is minorities pay the price.
Do you see it the same way, Tom, where Jackson sort of accelerates something that had begun years before he really took it to the next level?
Well, he certainly smashed the whole political caucus system and kind of ended the reign of the aristocrats. But also, I'd go back to John Adams, the Alien and Sedition Acts, which Trump would probably favor very much because that's what you're hearing in his rhetoric. But also, you know, before he left office, he was so upset that the Federalists lost, he loaded up the federal judiciary with, you know, judicial appointments of Federalists. So he tried to subvert the very constitutional system that, frankly, was not that, you know, old at the time. So, you know, what recent problems, you can see it going back to the second presidency.
We're talking about the office of the presidency, whether it's become too powerful, with historians Stephen Knott and Thomas Whalen. And listeners, we'd love for you to chime in as well. Again, the number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. As I said a moment ago, the current president, Donald Trump, sometimes compares himself to Andrew Jackson. He seems to feel a real kinship there. And he talked a little bit about this a couple of years ago on the 250th anniversary of Jackson's birth in Nashville. Here is President Trump at that time.
It was during the Revolution that Jackson first confronted and defied an arrogant elite. Does that sound familiar to you? I wonder why they keep talking about Trump and Jackson, Jackson and Trump.
So, Stephen Knott, why do they keep talking about Trump and Jackson and Jackson and Trump? I mean, do you see the similarities there, or is it a bit of a stretch?
There are some similarities. There's also some stretching involved. But part of the reason we keep talking about it is because people around President Trump have drawn that connection. And President Trump has Andrew Jackson's portrait in the Oval Office, so you frequently see it when you see shots of the Oval Office. Look, they both viewed themselves as taking on the elites of their day. The differences between Jackson and Trump, though, I mean, Jackson truly was a self-made man. He was a general. We could argue the merits of his generalship. There were certainly some problems with that. But he is a self-made man. Donald Trump is not a self-made man.
And in that comment that he was part of the revolution, well, not really. You know, Jackson's presidency was you know, decades after the American Revolution. But, you know, Jackson, he is reflective of the times because now the right to vote is extended to kind of regular everyday people, kind of the blue collar white, you know, workers of the 19th century. And you notice that certain presidents, you know, when there's a change in, like, when you broaden the franchise, certain presidents reflect the changes. And I think it was inevitable for Jackson to do so. He is representative of the common man. I think it's a stretch to say that Donald Trump is representative of the common man, given his own background.
Well, Tom, what about the comparisons to another Andrew Johnson? I mean, we heard a lot of those in recent months as we were going through impeachment, right? We've had very few presidents actually be impeached, Andrew Johnson being one of them. Is that a better parallel, the other Andrew to Donald Trump?
I think so, especially in personality terms, very stubborn. And they thought, you know, the presidency, you know, gave them the right to kind of supersede congressional oversight in many cases. Though Johnson himself was always, you know, arguing that he was defending the Constitution. And of course, you know, it went down to like one single vote in the impeachment trial in the Senate.
Stephen, you said something earlier about the risks of populism when you have these presidents who sort of see themselves as speaking for the masses, for a whole group of people. And you've written that there's something sort of ironic about that mentality in the sense that there's something almost inherently arrogant about believing that you are the voice of a whole bunch of people, right? Can you elaborate on that?
Yeah, sure. And you did see that with Andrew Jackson, and I think you certainly see it with President Trump and some other presidents that we've had. And that's this inability to separate themselves from the office they hold. But if you do consider yourself the voice of the people, the tribune of the people, that's pretty heady stuff. And it's easy to blur that line between your political well-being and the well-being of the office of the president and of the United States of America. Andrew Jackson blurred that line. Andrew Johnson blurred that line. I think Richard Nixon blurred it, and I think Donald Trump blurs it.
You also, though, in your writing, point to some presidents who might surprise readers. Woodrow Wilson, FDR, presidents who were, I would say, generally remembered fondly. And yet you say that sometimes it was those progressive presidents who perhaps most overstretched the bounds of the office as it was originally envisioned and have paved the road to Donald Trump. How so?
Yeah, Woodrow Wilson's an interesting case because Wilson spoke openly of the president and the person holding that office being as big a man as he can be. And he said the limits of the office are just the limits that the man himself brings to it. That's, in my view, a dangerous way of thinking. Now, Wilson, you know, is followed by Franklin Roosevelt, who uses this technology that we're using today to develop a bond with the American public, which, you know, helped get us out of the Depression, no question about it. But the problem is, the more you personalize the presidency and the more you remove it from its constitutional constraints, it seems to me that the potential for danger is there. And I would argue we're seeing some of those dangers today.
So once again, the number, if you'd like to join our conversation about the presidency, is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Tell us, do you think the presidency has become too powerful? Or do you need a strong leader to get anything done in Washington these days? Tom, I'm curious how you come down on populism, because we also see a different brand of it in the 2020 race, and actually 4 years ago as well, in Bernie Sanders on the liberal side of a populist movement. And again, I think you would see a lot of working class people who see him as their champion. I wonder if you see any of the same risks that Steve writes about in that kind of populist figure were he to take the White House.
Well, absolutely. And, you know, they're two sides of the same coin, Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump, as far as I'm concerned. And, you know, they're basically running on the campaign slogan of FDR in the 1930s, you know, therefore the forgotten man in American politics, you know, that blue collar type who globalization has passed by. And basically the only difference is, well, their prescription, you know, Bernie wants, expansive social, you know, welfare state. You know, Trump basically says we have to just cut taxes, limit government to a certain extent, and, you know, prosperity will follow. But, you know, what they're arguing, they have the same goal, but they're just going about it in slightly different means.
You know, one of the other things I want to think about, too, is what might be able to correct the course. So you write a little bit about this, Steve, in your book. I mean, in fact, it's in the title, right? The prospects for renewal. So what are those prospects for renewal? And as we talk about this, I'm particularly mindful of the recent news just last week when the Senate passed a version of a War Powers Act that would curb the president's war-making power in Iran in particular. Now, they didn't get a veto-proof majority, so it may not go anywhere. But there does seem to be some bipartisan agreement that perhaps the power of the presidency has maybe become a little bit too great, at least in the war-making department. I mean, is that the type of thing you see on the horizon?
I used to be a critic of sort of congressional attempts to rein in presidential war power. I'm rethinking that as we speak. But let me say, I think there's a couple things we can do, one of which, in my view, would be to restore the role of party leaders in terms of presidential selection. 2016 is a perfect example of that. Donald Trump showed no indications up until 2016 that he was a Republican. He was not the choice of party leaders. Had party leaders had more of a say, I'm not sure he wins the nomination. I'm not sure he wins the presidency. Same with Sanders in 2016. And to this day, Sanders is not a member of the Democratic Party.
And Bloomberg was a former Republican.
Great. So, look, you know, if we restored some of the old smoke room, you know, the back room where party and look, I know that goes against the grain.
I was just going to say, I mean, we just had James Roosevelt from the Democratic Rules Committee on the phone saying they're trying to go the other direction to be a little bit more transparent. And if I understand right, I mean, part of the idea by having these delegates at a convention or even the Electoral College after a general election is that, you know, if something were to change, if we were to learn something dramatic about a problem with the nominee or the president-elect, you'd have sort of that safeguard to make a change later. I mean, is that the kind of sort of stopgap you're talking
about? That's exactly what I'm talking about. And the other thing, if I could mention, and this is a much longer term solution, I think we need to really invest in civic education. I'm not sure the American public is aware of a lot of the issues that we're talking about today. They're not aware, I don't think, that there's an alternative way of looking at the presidency that governed this country for 120 years. And so that's going to take a while to get that message out there, but we can do better.
All right, let's bring a call into the conversation. Rob is in Newburyport. Rob, what's on your mind?
Hey, everybody. I'm wondering if there's a breaking point for the Republican Party, right? You know, the Republicans in Nixon's time, there was a breaking point, right? They went to him, they said, you know, we're going to vote against you. And he broke. And is that going to happen to this president ever? You know, let me give you a quick sports analogy, okay? The New England Patriots, they didn't win the Super Bowl this year. But let's just say they didn't lose the playoff game. Let's say they won the game on a penalty. And everybody saw it in the replay. Clearly it was a penalty that was in their favor, but they won the game. Half the audience would say, well, you know what? We had it come. We've had some bad plays against us this year, and, you know, we're going on to the playoffs. And then in the next game, same thing happens. Last play of the game, there's a horrible, irrefutable penalty, but we win. And then same thing happens in the Super Bowl. At what point does Tom Brady Bill Belichick. I'm using them obviously symbolically here. At what point do fans say, you know what, I don't want to win this way. I don't want to be associated with a team that, you know, it's black and white. It's on video. You can see the penalty.
Got it. Rob, it's a good point, and I'll put the question to Tom Whalen here. What about that? I mean, is there a breaking point for the Republican Party? I mean, we just had an impeachment, and only one senator, Mitt Romney, voted to convict.
Right. Honestly, I don't see it. And you have to remember, back in the 70s, the Republican Party was much more diverse and represented, you know, it was a true national party. And what's happened in modern times is parties have retrenched themselves into certain areas of the country, regionalization, and certain ideologies, right? So, I mean, the Republican Party now is a small ideological base. It doesn't have moderates anymore. You know, the closest to a moderate is a Mitt Romney, who already is right of center. The same thing with the Democratic Party. And I agree with Steve. If you're going to have change, it's going to have to be like bipartisan basis to kind of rein in this imperial presidency. And that's what it is, an imperial presidency. But unfortunately, I just don't see it on the horizon that Republicans and Democrats coming together and, you know, especially in the Senate, you know, to protect their institutional and rights and then just kind of challenge the presidency. As we just saw in the impeachment process, that didn't happen. And, you know, I think lately I've been thinking of Octavian Caesar, of all people, you know, and he gutted the old Roman Republic, right? I mean, and, you know, what he did was very clever. He kept the institutions in place, like the Roman Senate, you know, and he claimed that he saved the Republic, but he loaded them with his loyalists and gave them essentially no power. And that killed the Republic in the ancient days. And you got to wonder, I wonder if that's the game plan for Donald Trump, given the moves he's made, that, you know, he's gutted all these institutions. He's gone after the intelligence agencies. Now he's using the judicial system, you know, and the Department of Justice. So, I mean, it's very depressing to see what he's done, what this one person has done. But if you look back over the last 50 years, it's not surprising. The presidency has accumulated a lot of powers under Democrats and Republicans, and a lot driving that, and we haven't really talked about that, is foreign policy issues. The Cold War is what created, you know, this imperial presidency. And even after the Cold War, it did not cease, because now we have this thing called 9/11. And, you know, what I worry about now, if we have another event like 9/11 or anything close to it, what this president would do, feeling no restraint, you know, could he, you know, conceivably suspend constitutional order? I wouldn't put that by him.
Let's take one more while we still have time. Bill is in Chelmsford. Go ahead, Bill.
Yeah, good afternoon, gentlemen. You touched base about something about selecting nominees and going back to a little bit of the backroom politics of it all. You know, something that I think is taken away from a good selection is we allow unenrolled in many states to just choose their party on the day of the election, up to the day of the election. And there's no commitment to any ideals or philosophies or anything. And I think that's kind of, it's too bad, because people who are unenrolled can join Republican that day and then just opt out. And this election doesn't have any real roots to a choice. And I think that's a big problem, because we don't have, you said Bernie's not a member of the Democratic Party. He's not. And we look at Bloomberg, up until a few years ago, he was a Republican. I think that could change the whole dynamic. So if a two-party system, maybe we'd have some other parties that might have some strength if we gave we required people to be part of it. We wouldn't let people vote on a company's annual meeting unless they were stockholders. And right now, we don't have any real stockholders in the parties or the selection. That's just my thought.
All right, Bill, thanks for the ring. In the minute that we've got left, Steve, let me just put that question to you. And I guess the counter would be, but, you know, if you do it that way, are you making the process less transparent? You're making people pick sides. They got to choose a party. Doesn't that make us more partisan?
It makes it less transparent. I would still argue that the pluses outweigh the minuses. Look, we've had a lot of mediocre presidents, certainly a lot of the 19th century presidents. Shouldn't end up on Mount Rushmore. On the other hand, they didn't do a lot of damage. And part of the reason was that the party leaders had a tendency to pick those people who were temperamentally suited for the presidency. They're not going to be the greatest people necessarily, but they did not do damage. And as I say in this book, I would take a Benjamin Harrison or a Chester Alan Arthur over Donald Trump any day.
They're not the ones we remember or we put on the money or the mountains, as you say, but those caretaker presidencies, perhaps a bit underrated. Stephen Knott, presidential historian, professor of national security affairs at the Naval War College, and author of The Lost Soul of the American Presidency, The Decline into Demagoguery, and the Prospects for Renewal. Thank you so much for joining us on this President's Day.
Thank you.
Our thanks also to Thomas Whalen, political historian and professor of social science at Boston University. Thanks to you for also joining us.
Thank you.